Good evening, everyone. So I want to take this opportunity, first of all, to welcome everyone. It's always beautiful to see when people take time out of a hectic, manic schedule to be able to come together and learn a little bit of Torah. I also know that we put this together with not too much notice, so I appreciate people coming out on such short notice. It's really beautiful, really wonderful, and I'm sure that we're going to all be enriched from the beautiful words of Torah that we're going to hear this evening. I want to introduce our very special guest speaker tonight with an interesting idea. We know that when we perform the mitzvah of Sfiras Omer and we count each and every night, so you'll notice that in different Siddurim, there are different girsos, there are different texts. And so some people count certain number of days La'omer, and others count Ba'omer. So of course you know that in Judaism, nothing is haphazard. Everything has a meaning, and the truth is, more often than not, not only do things have a meaning, but they often have a deep and profound meaning. And this fundamental difference in textual approach to counting the Omer is rooted in two fundamentally different understandings of the mitzvah. Those who go ahead and count each and every night La'omer understand that the count is rooted in the Karban Ha'omer. Ultimately, again, we know the Torah tells us that on the second day of Pesach, we offer up a very unique carbon, a carbon that comes from barley. We only find it in one other instance in the Torah. And therefore, when we count, the count itself is triggered by the sacrificial rite of the Karban HaOmer. And so we count that today is so-and-so days, La Omer, when the Karban HaOmer would have been brought. As opposed to counting Ba Omer, in the midst of the Omer, is a recognition that there's no longer a Karban HaOmer. There's no longer this beautiful sacrificial rite. We have lost our second Beis HaMikdash, and we have yet to be given the gift of the third. So we count Ba'omer. We no longer count according to the Karban, because the Karban is no longer, but rather we root ourselves in the present. And I think that within these two different textual approaches to the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer, yields two profound, different, but yet importantly, joint concepts. Judaism, Rabbi Schachter spoke about this in one of his sessions earlier today. Judaism is a religion, is a way of life that straddles past, present, and future. What Rav Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, called a unitive time consciousness. That the Jew, just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu is HaYehovah V'Yeh, God is past, present, and future, so too the Jew has the ability to defy the continuum of time and simultaneously live in the past while experiencing the present and eagerly anticipating the future. And so when we go ahead and we count the Sfira, the question is, what are we focusing on? So those who will count La Omer will say, perhaps we count the Sfira, Zecher L'Churban, will remember that which we have lost, versus those who count Ba Omer will understand, yes, although there is a time for reflecting on that which has been lost, but we also have to focus on maximizing the present. We can't live life just La Omer, but we have to live life Ba Omer. Rav Soloveitchik had a very interesting practice. And the Rav, when he would count Sfira, would count first reciting Ba Omer, and then immediately afterwards would recite the counting La Omer. And I think contained in this practice, it wasn't just the Rav, his father, his grandfather did the same thing as well. And I think contained in this practice is an incredible approach to Judaism. And I think an approach which truly embodies the essence of the Rav. To begin Ba'omer ultimately tells us that we really have to spend life maximizing every moment. We have to take advantage of the opportunities that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends our way. We have to make sure that we live life to the fullest, living life with the mantra of Carpe Diem. Because we know that life is a finite, non-renewable resource. And so we must make sure to maximize every moment. But one who only lives in the present, without a connection to the past, leads an untethered, unanchored life. So yes, you have to count Ba'omer, but you also have to live La'omer. Maximize the present, but always remain anchored and tethered to your past. And those of us who have had the privilege to learn many of Rav Soloveitchik's works understand that this is a true personification of who and what the Rav was. The Rav was an individual through his writings, although I did not have the schus to learn under the Rav. I have had the schus to learn under the Talmidim of the Rav. And from what I've learned from my Rebbeim, from what I've seen from the writings of the Rav was very focused on this idea of, on one hand, a constant fidelity maintaining allegiance to the Masorah. So much of our identity is rooted in the past, is rooted on who and what we have become throughout the ages. So much of our identity is La Omer. But at the same time, the mandate that each of us have is to cultivate a meaningful Ba Omer identity as well. To make sure that we utilize the present, we use our kohos, we use our abilities to forge something magnificent for ourselves and for the world around us. And what a beautiful privilege it is for us tonight to be able to hear from one of the Talmidim of the Rav, an individual who has gone on, based on the tutelage of his Rebbe and of his other Rebbeim and teachers, to really become a true, I was trying to think of the right word to describe Rabbi Schachter, teacher, but that's not enough. Rabbi, it's not enough. Rav, it's not enough. The best I could think of was a two-sided coin. A Rebbe and a Rebbe. A Rebbe and a Rebbe. Because those are two different things. A Rebbe is someone who gives you information, but you may not connect individually with your Rebbe. You could come into a shir, you can get incredible insights into Torah, but then you go home and you go on with your life. A Rebbe is someone who takes an active interest in your life. A Rebbe is someone who cares about you, not because of who you are or what you've accomplished or what titles you have or what you may become. But a Rebbe is someone who cares about you because they've taken you under their wing. Because they care about your success simply as a fellow Jew and a fellow human being. So although Rabbi Schachter, yes, is a university professor of Jewish history and Jewish thought and a senior scholar at Yeshiva University, I would venture to say that Rabbi Schachter's greatest accomplishments for rabbis like myself and for others is that to so many, he's not only a Rebbe, but he's also a Rebbe. Rabbi Schachter is here in town. The reason we have such a wonderful privilege in the beginning of the week to hear from Rabbi Schachter is because Yeshiva University is hosting a Yarchei Kala. Each and every year, the Center for the Jewish Future, under the leadership of Rabbi Schachter, has developed a number of cohorts. The best part of this process is I never knew the word cohort before I attended the Yarchei Kalas. Groups of rabbis, again, of all ages, all backgrounds, all demographics, all different places in the United States and beyond, come together once a year for 3 days. 3 days, 2.5 days of camaraderie, of just a little bit of relaxation, but most importantly, at least I speak for myself, spiritual rejuvenation. And the person who spiritually rejuvenates us is our Rebbe and our Rebbe. The person who gives us Rabbanim, because contrary to popular opinion, it's not easy to be a rabbi. Yes, we get 2 days a week of golf, right? And Baruch Hashem, the covet is boundless. You know, but at the end of the day, even rabbis need someone to recharge their spiritual batteries. And what a coveted and wonderful opportunity it is for us today, tonight, to have someone, first of all, who embodies the legacy of the Rav. Someone, again, through his Talmidim and beyond, who teaches us how to remain anchored in our Masorah, anchored in our past, but also teaches us the skills of self-actualization. So that not only can we develop into our own, but we have the ability to take our kohos as Rabbanim and inspire our communities and inspire the worlds that are at our reach. It's my pleasure to ask our Rebbe, our Rebbe, the man who truly personifies so many of the beautiful values that made Rav Soloveitchik a Manei Gadol, Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter, to share with us some words of Torah. Sorry, just one other quick announcement. As you know, unfortunately, shortly before Pesach, Rabbi Schachter lost his father, Rabbi Herschel Schachter. And we're going to take this opportunity tonight to dedicate all of the communal Talmud Torah Le'ilui Nishmas Harav Tzvi Ben Harav Pinchas. And we hope that in the merit of our communal Talmud Torah, his special neshama will have an aliyah. I also want to thank Dr. Gary and Sherry Bauman for sponsoring tonight's lecture, as well as the Appreciating the Rav series. And halavai, in the merit of this communal Talmud Torah, Rabbi Schachter's neshama should have an aliyah, and halavai, beautiful things should happen for all of Klal Yisrael.
We ate already. It's fine. It's okay. Thank you. I want to thank Rabbi Silber very much for that warm introduction. It's really an honor and a pleasure for me to be here and to be here this evening. Rabbi Silber mentioned that what brings me to town, what brings about 40 or 45 rabbis from all across North America to town, is an opportunity to spend time with one another, to gain a different perspective on issues that are facing our community, and to gain strength from one from the other. But this particular Yarche Kala here in Baltimore has an extra benefit, and that is that I think that the reason why a lot of the Chevra came to Baltimore is because they wanted to have the opportunity to interact with your rabbi, with your Murad Asra, with our host, with Rabbi Silber. In our Chabura, and it's a growing Chabura, your rabbi is looked up to, very much so, for his wisdom and for his learning. And so many of his colleagues seek his advice. And you are, Baruch Hashem, extremely blessed to have such an extraordinary rabbi as the leader of this community. I want to say something that might embarrass Rabbi Silber, but it's something that left a lasting impression on me since I first heard it. And I actually can't stop thinking about it. It's a conversation that I had with a balabas in this shul the last time that I was here. I was just here in October, I think. It was shortly after Yom Tov. I had the pleasure of spending a wonderful Shabbos. And after davening on Shabbos morning, an elderly balabas who was sitting somewhere in this section came over to me and he said to me, "Rabbi, you know, did you ever wonder, you know, you go into a sukkah and you go into people's homes and you see pictures of great famous rabbis. And the great famous rabbis whose pictures you see, they have white hair and they have white beards. Did you ever wonder what they looked like when they were younger? Because we don't have pictures of them when they were younger because they weren't a great rabbi yet. But did you ever wonder?" And I said, "I know, that's such a fascinating question. It never occurred to me." He said, "Well, it's obvious. You see Rabbi Silber? Just look at Rabbi Silber. That's what they looked like when they were younger." And I have to tell you, I have never, ever heard that kind of respect for a rabbi of a community. And that's from one person, and it can only, I can imagine, be multiplied many times. Rabbi Silber, I want to give you many, many brachas from the depths of my heart that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give you the kayach to continue to be such an extraordinary Murad Asra, such an extraordinary rabbi for the community that's blessed to have you, for all your chaverim who look to you, and for the Jewish people that continues to benefit from all of your wisdom and all of your greatness. It's a pleasure to acknowledge the presence of my brother-in-law, Rabbi Beryl Weisbord, who is here, and Dr. Aviva Weisbord, who is somewhere. I don't see her, but she's probably over there. So, hi. And my wonderful nephews who are here to really, really, really tremendously honor me by your presence. I want to thank Dr. Gary and Sherry Bauman for sponsoring this evening and the lecture series in memory of Carl Bauman, Yehuda Ben Baruch, Zichrono Livracha. And I'm very grateful to Rabbi Silber for including my own father, Zichrono Livracha, as a focus for the learning. When I was speaking to Rabbi Silber about perhaps sharing some thoughts this evening, he told me that he's starting now a lecture series on Rav Soloveitchik. We just commemorated the 20th yahrzeit of the Rav. And maybe I could take over the first lecture. The topic for this evening was going to be on Kol Dodi Do Feik, on fate and destiny and religious Zionism. Maybe I could, in the course of my remarks on Rabbi Soloveitchik, give a more general overview and then perhaps focus a little bit on that specific theme. It is impossible for anybody to try to capture in any meaningful way the greatness of this extraordinary human being. The Torah, the Chachma, the wisdom, being a Manig Yisrael, so much that he was. And to think that in an hour or even more, it is possible to give over appropriately what the Rav was simply is incomprehensible. So what I decided to do was to speak very personally. What I decided to do is to try to address the following question. And the question that I asked myself was, why should I care about Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik 20 years after he passed away and around 30 years after he no longer played a role, an active role in the American and world Jewish community? The Rav was sick for a number of years, the end of his life. He wasn't Tofes Mokom anymore in the firmament of the Jewish leadership. So let's say it's 30 years plus since the Rav B'Malai Kai Chaysav had what to say. So why should it matter to me? I know there are a lot of beautiful Divrei Torah, but more than that, why is the existence of this person central to my identity as a Jew? And so what I'd like to share with you are a few themes that I touched upon that resonate deeply with me and that I hope will resonate with you, with the full understanding and hakdama and introduction. This is very personal and it's very private, and it does not at all mean to cover the subject as the subject deserves to be covered. The first point that I want to make, and I think the point of departure of any conversation about Rabbi Soloveitchik, has to be the centrality of Talmud Torah and the centrality of Halacha. Here was a person who spent so much of his life learning and teaching. He spent his early years with a Cheder Melamed in Chaslavich. He learned with his father 10 hours a day for 10 years. One Yahrzeit shiur that he delivered every year on Gimel Shvat, in memory of his father, he rattled off 23 mesechtes that he learned with his father. It's a lot of time, 23 mesechtes that he learned with his father. And then he said the 24th mesechta was after they finished learning Nedarim with the Ran, they said, you know what, let's try to do Nedarim with Rashi. So we don't do Nedarim with Rashi. Rashi probably isn't Rashi on Nedarim. We do Nedarim with the Ran. But you know what? Let's just see how it works out doing Nedarim with Rashi. So it's sort of 23 and a half mesechtes. And of course, he spent his life in a way that he referred to himself as a melamed, very much in keeping with the role of the Rabbona Shel Olam, Hamalame Torah L'Amo Yisrael. So Talmud Torah was central to him. And halachic observance and halachic categories were central to him. But rather than just asserting something that is quite obvious, I'd like to underscore this point in the following way. After the 1967 war, the Six-Day War, when Shechiyanu v'kiyemanu v'yonu l'zman hazeh, when the city of Yerushalayim and so many other parts of biblical Israel were conquered by the Israeli Defense Forces, when the Ribbono Shel Olam blessed us with the opportunity to reunify the city of Yerushalayim, many people raised the question, that the text of a tefillah that we recite at Mincha and Tisha B'Av seems no longer to be appropriate. In the tefillah of Nachem that we say, we refer to Yerushalayim as Shvela, Bezuya, Shomema, that it's desolate, that it's empty, that it's destroyed, Chareva. And there were voices who suggested that it can't be. It's not true. It's just not true. Setitzach, Salebedik, Zakachzach, so many people, it's packed. I had the privilege myself, the first time that I was in Israel, it was 2 weeks after the Six-Day War, and that Tisha B'Av, we walked around the Chomot, the walls of the old city of Yerushalayim, hundreds of thousands of Jews, and we mamish felt like it was a Yom Tov, and you had to pinch yourself to say that it's Tisha B'Av. It's Tisha B'Av today. It felt like everything but Tisha B'Av. So how can I say? Voices were raised. Chareva, Shomema, Bezuya, Mibli Boneha, Baruch Hashem, it's packed. And the response to this was varied. The first entry on the first page is an example of someone and of a school of thought that took this charge and critique so seriously that they removed the Nusach of Nachem from the Siddur and they made a whole new Nusach. Not only doesn't it have these words, but it's a whole new text. And there were a number of people who did this. Short of that, Reb Chaim David Alevi, who was then the Sephardi Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv, felt that there was basis to this, and he referred to it as Divrei Sheker. It's Divrei Sheker, he said, to say Chareva Shemema Bezuya. So rather than reinventing the entire Nusach HaTfilah, what he did was, is he changed one word. If you look at the bottom of the first page, not Ve'esoyir Chareva Bezuya, but Ve'esoyir Shehoiso Chareva Bezuya. Not he Yosheves V'Rosh HaChafui, but he Yoshva V'Rosh HaChafui. In other words, what he's doing here, in a very slight twist, in order Lohitzi from what it would appear Divrei Sheker, I'm using his terminology, he said, no, not is, but was. So the text essentially remains intact with a little tweaking to accommodate the current reality. On page 2, I xerox from a tshuva from Rabbi Avadia Yosef, who's unalterably opposed to any change in the Nusach. Absolutely unacceptable. Rabbi Avadia says, Chas v'shalom, how can you tamper with the Nusach HaTfilah? We're talking here about a Nusach that was Niskan al Yidei Rabbi Seinu HaKadoshim, Asher Ruach Hashem Diber Bam, Genuzim Bohen Sodos Nisgoim Umufloim. What are you doing? You have no right. Letakein, in quotes, to fix the text. There is layers of meaning in this text that you don't even begin to understand. And he continues, the historical reality is not so simple that bemoaning the lack of the fullness of Yerushalayim would be inappropriate. He talks about the fact in the second paragraph, Ki Mokom HaMikdash Usvivosav Nesunim Biyad Zorim Sonei Yisrael. So the Waqf is in charge of the Temple Mount, and Yerushalayim HaAtika Odena Malaya Gilulim Shel Akum Bekama Knesios Temeos Vasher Al Yidei Komrehem Umanhigeyem Dam Yisrael Nishbach Kamayim Bechol Adoros. And he continues to say that there are many shuls that flourished in the Ir Atika that are still Chorev. So even the historical reality is not so poshut to say, oh, everything is fine, it's okay, now we can no longer say these words. All this by way of introduction to Rav Soloveitchik's position, the bottom of page 2. Rav Soloveitchik was also unalterably opposed to changing the nusach. The first rationale that he gives is similar to the one that I just mentioned to you. You can't change a nusach hatfilah. This is kodesh kodashim. You can't mess with the text of the davening. It is absolutely inappropriate. And then he added something that I want to use to begin tonight's presentation. There's a machlekes rishonim. What is the status of the city of Yerushalayim? There's a Mishnah Maseches Rosh Hashanah and a Mishnah Maseches Sukkah that differentiates two categories, Mikdash and Medina. So in the Beis HaMikdash, Lulav was Nitol Kol Shiva, and in Medina was only Yom Echad. For example, so the Beis HaMikdash, Lekachtam Lachem, Bayom HaRishon Lachem, wherever you are, it's only one day. Usmachtam lefnei Hashem Elokeichem in the Makom HaMikdash lefnei Hashem Elokeichem Shivasya. However, the problem arises because there's one middle category for Sinishtahin and Ishtaher. It's not Mikdash and it's not Medina. Medina means the entire country, namely the city of Yerushalayim. So does Yerushalayim have a status of Mikdash? Or does Yerushalayim have a status of Medina? Because there are only two options that we have in the Mishnah. So Rashi says that Yerushalayim has the status of Medina, and there are four places in the parish of Mishnayos LaHarambam, in Sukkah, and in Rosh Hashanah, and in Ma'aseh Sheni, there are four places where the Rambam says Yerushalayim has the halach of Mikdash. That the halachic status of Yerushalayim is like Mikdash. I remember when I was learning in the Miri Yeshiva in Yerushalayim right after the Six-Day War, they told us that on Chol HaMoed Sukkot we should go to the Kotel and we should daven Shacharis in the Kotel, because in front of the Kotel as halacha is Yerushalayim, and Yerushalayim as halacha of Mikdash according to the Rambam. So why should we be Mekayim Arba Minim Derabbanan if we stayed in Me'e Sha'arim in the Yeshiva? We have an opportunity, according to the Rambam, to be Mekayim Arba Minim Da'iraisa, because in Mikdash it's 7 days, and Yerushalayim has Allah of Mikdash. Said Rabbi Soloveitchik, you dare not tamper with the Nusach of Nachem. You're going to tell me it's Da'iver Shkarim, because how can I say Chareva Shemema Bezuya? The answer is, the way you understand reality is not reality. Reality is not defined by your eyes, but reality is defined by halachic categories. And if halachically, lefishitas harambam Yerushalayim as a halachic status of Mikdash, so kozman Mikdash is charav, Yerushalayim is charav. Kozman Mikdash is shemema, Yerushalayim is shemema. You'll tell me it's not so. The answer is, you're not looking at it properly. You're only looking at it the way you think it looks. But that's not what defines reality. What defines reality is a halachic status. And Kozman it has, according to the Rambam, a halachic status of Mikdash. So halachically, it's charav. Halachically, it's desolate. Halachically, it's destroyed. And it's that which defines the reality. For me, this is so powerful, because for me it underscores, and again, this is just my own personal perceptions, that it's not just that halacha was central to the life of Rabbi Soloveitchik, it's not just Talmud Torah was central to the life of Rabbi Soloveitchik, but halacha defined a reality. It's a whole different way of looking at things when we look at it through the lens of halachic status. Halacha was so central, top of page 3, that for Rabbi Soloveitchik it also defined his philosophical world. So we know very well that in addition to being a major Talmud Chacham, the Rav was also a major philosopher, published a number of works on philosophy, centrality of philosophy, wrote his doctoral dissertation on Hermann Cohen, on neo-Kantianism, on late 19th, early 20th century German philosophy. But the Rambam, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, wasn't 100%, because the Rambam utilized extra Jewish sources in order to build his own philosophical tradition. Anybody who knows anything about the Rambam understands that Aristotle and Aristotelian philosophy was central to the philosophy of the Rambam. And the Rav said and wrote, the top of page 3, this comes from a book entitled Halachic Mind. It's the last page of this work. He wrote it in the 40s. He kept it in his drawer. And for some reason it got pulled out of his drawer in the middle 80s and it got published under the title of the Halachic Mind. Second paragraph, to this end, there is only a single source from which a Jewish philosophical Weltanschauung could emerge. The objective order, the halach. If you want to construct a philosophical tradition in Judaism, there's only one place to go. Last sentence, last paragraph of the entire book, out of the sources of halach, a new worldview awaits formulation. For Rabbi Soloveitchik, the halachic system wasn't just a mode of behavior, but it was a scaffolding of an entire way of thinking. And authentic Jewish philosophy is rooted in halacha. So halacha defines reality, and halacha is at the core of something that we might not normally identify with the nitty-gritty of the halachic system, namely an authentic Jewish philosophical tradition. Everything for the Rav revolved around halacha. This year, 2013, is the 20th Yahrzeit of the Rav. It's the 60th anniversary of the publication of a most interesting volume published by Isaiah Berlin, who was a leading public intellectual in England, in Oxford, London, 1953, entitled The Hedgehog and the Fox, bottom of page 3. Subtitled, An Essay on Tolstoy's View of History. Isaiah Berlin here, in his work, divides the leading intellectual figures of the Western tradition into two categories. Either they're hedgehogs or they're foxes. There is a line among the fragments, I'm reading the first two, three lines in this book. There is a line among the fragments of the Greek poet Archilochus, which says, the fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. So there are some thinkers a little further down, who relate everything to a single central vision, to one system less or more coherent or articulate. There's a single universal organizing principle, in terms of which alone all that they say and all that they are significant. And then there are other thinkers who have, let's call it, a multiplicity of truths. There are other thinkers who pursue many ends, often unrelated, maybe even contradictory, related by no single moral or aesthetic principle. And he goes on to say that Dante belongs to the category of foxes, and Shakespeare is a hedgehog, and Plato and Lucretius and Aristotle and v'chule. I mention this because I want to use this as a way of defining that the way I understand it in this typology, I would say that Rabbi Soloveitchik was a hedgehog, which means that everything revolved around one basic yesod. You could do this also for Jewish thinkers. I would say Lamushel, it's a whole separate conversation, I would say, LaMushel, that the Ramban was a fox, and the Rambam was a hedgehog. For the Rambam, there's one basic yesod. For the Ramban, there are a multiplicity of yesodists. And one can, I think, in a useful way, try to get a handle on the way different leaders of our tradition thought by seeing them from this perspective. And in order to underscore the centrality of halacha, I would say that the Rav was a hedgehog. The hedgehog knows one big thing, and the one big thing around which everything else revolved is the centrality of halacha and the importance of Talmud Torah. Page 4, point number 2. Another reason why the Rav is so important to me personally is because the Rav combined intellect and emotion. So if you were to ask me a number of years ago to draw a picture of Rabbi Soloveitchik, so just so happened that I had the privilege of knowing Rabbi Soloveitchik. He was the Masada Kedushin at my wedding and my wife, and spent a lot of time with him in Boston. I was a student of his older son-in-law, Professor Tversky. But if I didn't know who he was and know what he looked like, if you asked me to draw a picture of him many years ago, I would have drawn one big, huge circle, like Kuloi brain, Kuloi intellect, one big, huge head. But, you know, he had a hand over here, a little line, and he had a hand, and he had a foot, and like a few little line aloch coming out of the big, huge circle. A genius, a towering, powerful intellect. Turns out that in addition to having a powerful brain, Rabbi Soloveitchik also had a powerful heart and was repeatedly engaged in expressing the emotional connection to Torah and to mitzvahs. I would say my all-time high favorite source and quote from all of the works of the Rama, that of the Rav, interesting slip, that we have, is the hesped that he gave for his machatenista on the top left of page 4. His machatenista, my teacher's mother, Mrs. Tversky, the Tolna Rebbetzin. And in being maspid, his machatenista, he talks about the role of the Jewish mother. And talking about the role of the Jewish mother, what does he know about a Jewish mother? He knows a great deal about a Jewish mother because he had a Jewish mother. And he tells us the following. I admit that I'm not able to define precisely the Masoretic role of the Jewish mother. Only by circumscription I hope to be able to explain it. Permit me to draw upon my own experiences. I used to have long conversations with my mother. In fact, it was a monologue rather than a dialogue. She talked, and I happened to overhear. What did she talk about? I must use the halachic term in order to answer the question. Me'inyana diyoma. She used to talk about things that are relevant to what was going on at the time. I used to watch her arranging the house in honor of a holiday. I used to see her recite the prayers. I used to watch her recite the Seder every Friday night. And I still remember the nostalgic tune I learned from her very much. Most of all, I learned. Most of all, I learned from my mother that Judaism expresses itself not only in formal compliance with the law, but also in a living experience. It's not just do it. It's not just fulfill it. It's not just act upon it, but it's also to experience it. She taught me, my mother taught me, that there's a flavor, a scent, and a warmth, a varamkeit to mitzvahs. I learned from her the most important thing in life. The most important thing in life I learned from my mother. And what it is to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders. The most important thing in life, the most, hey hayidia, is to feel a personal connection with the Rabbona Shalom. That God is in my life, and I feel the glet of God on my cheek, I feel the hug on my shoulder, I feel it. Because the worst thing in life is to feel like you're alone. And the ultimate way not to feel like you're alone is if you could somehow develop a relationship with God who's always next to you. I learned it from my mother, the most important thing in life, to feel the presence of the Almighty. Without her teachings, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive. So with all the Torah that he learned from his father, with all the 23 and a half Masechtis, and it's all wonderful, and he quoted his father all the time. Without his mother, he would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive. The laws of Shabbos were passed on to me by my father, Hilchas Shabbos. Shabbos was one of the 23 Masechtis, one of the 23 tractates that he learned with his father. He knows cold all the halachas of Shabbos. but the Shabbos as a living entity, as a queen, was revealed to me by my mother. The fathers knew much about the Shabbos. The mothers lived the Shabbos, experienced her presence, and perceived her beauty and splendor. There are many, many places, even just on this page, where Rabbi Soloveitchik talks about the experience of being Jewish, the experience of living a life in accordance with halacha. In fact, he uses a word on the right-hand column that's actually quite striking, and that word is romance. He uses the word romance. So for my whole life, I thought romance has to do with a man and a woman and a man, and you love each other, and you can't wait to be with each other, and you miss one another, and you want to do for one another, and you care about one another, and when you're not with one another, you can't wait to see one another again. And whatever you associate with romance, the Rav says that that is our relationship with the Rabbono Shel Olam, romance. Romance is in the fifth line in the second paragraph. Romance is in the third line from the bottom. It's a romantic relationship. And so therefore, I think what resonates with me deeply is this highlighting that, of course, the Maisa HaMitzvah, the Pe'ulas HaMitzvah is central. It's a Dairaisa, it's a Derabanan, it's a Minhag. We have to do what we believe God wants us to do. But we have to bring the fullness of who we are into that relationship, because it is a relationship. And the fullness of who we are means not just our hands, and not just our brains, but also our emotions, and our feelings, and the depth of our experiences into our relationship with God. Number three on page six, and this is something that I think about as I get older, and that has to do with, when you get older, you start thinking about, so what am I doing in this world? Rabbi Silber mentioned that my father, Zichrono Livracha, passed away a little over a month ago, so I think a lot about legacy, and I think a lot about accomplishments and wanting to leave the world a better place. And there are things in my own life that I feel okay about, and then there are things that I feel sad about and frustrated about and feel that I was not successful. I hope someday, maybe I will be, but the notion of coming to terms with incompletion in somebody's life. Rabbi Soloveitchik admitted failure. This is point number three, and it speaks to me very profoundly, and I think it liberates me to some extent. On page six, the Rav here writes again, yet again, about the centrality of the experience. There's a serious educational philosophical problem which has long troubled me. Orthodox youth have discovered Torah through scholastic forms of thought, intellectual contact, and cold logic. American yeshiva bachrim know how to learn. We can understand the Gemara. We got it. We can work our way through the sugya. However, they have not merited to discover her, the Torah, through a living, heart-pounding, invigorating sense of perception. They know the Torah is an idea, but they do not directly encounter her as a reality perceptible to taste and to sight and to touch. And the reason why, he says, is because maybe it's my fault. He says, maybe I didn't do the job I should have done, and maybe I'm responsible for the fact that my students are able to understand the sugya. They're able to understand what all the gedorim and all the categories of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are all about, but they really don't feel, and they don't internalize, what does it mean to live through a Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? He writes, Lefichach ani matzhir, it's in a little bit more than halfway down the first paragraph at the end, ki yesh biyadi la'atzbiya al echad ha'achrayim l'matzav hanochachi, that I'm able to point to one of those responsible for the current situation, V'hu ani ba'atmi. The notion that I didn't do the job that I would have hoped I would have been able to do. On page 7 is another iteration of this, where again, the Rav here specifically is talking about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And he writes about how, on the left side of page 7, a Jew is not only supposed to know what Yahadut stands for and to have knowledge of Yahadut, he's also called upon to experience Yahadut, to live it and to engage somehow in a romance. Here it is again with the Almighty. Let me make an admission here, I'll confide in you. This is the toughest of all jobs, the most difficult of all tasks. I know from my own experience how difficult it is to share and to inspire feelings in somebody else. I am not modest. I am far from being modest. I know that I'm a good teacher. I can teach halacha. I can explain the most abstract concepts. I can popularize the most complex Talmudic debate and break it down into its component parts. I can explain and elucidate abstract ideas, lemoshel, everything about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. But one thing I cannot do on the top of the next page. One thing I cannot do is to perfection, is to tell my students how I felt on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. You can describe the categories, but it's hard to convey the emotions. And he would try his best. He wrote often and spoke often about the Zeder Reb Chaim. When he was a little boy, he went to Reb Chaim for Yom Kippur, and Reb Chaim would say the Avodah. Or he would write about how they were sitting at the Seder with Reb Chaim, and after the Seder was over, Reb Chaim and Reb Moshe, the Zeder and the father would open up Masachas Pesachim, and they'd go straight to a Mulchamis in the back, under the riff, in the back of the Gemara. And he talked about how on Yom Kippur night, his father stayed up all night learning Masachas Yuma. It's an experience. It's not just categories. And he recognized, or at least he felt and said, that perhaps he didn't do the kind of job that he wanted to do. The younger son-in-law of Rav Soloveitchik, or Baron Lichtenstein, once said the following about the Rav. The Rav taught us the frailty of majesty and the majesty of frailty. I'm going to repeat it one more time because I think it's really profound. He taught us the frailty of majesty. Majesty isn't all that it's cracked up to be. And he taught us the majesty of frailty. There is a majesty to acknowledging the frailty of the human condition and the frailty of one's own experience. Page 8, next point. Point number 4, multiplicity of perspectives. So the Rav was a Rambam man. Chagad von Taten, the name of Zayden, I heard from my father in the name of my grandfather. The Rambam, Nochem al the Rambam, Vidaram al the Rambam, Mediuk and the Rambam, everything was the Rambam. 1937, the Rav founded a day school in Boston. Lo and behold, the name of the day school is the Maimonides School. Everything was the Rambam. The Rambam was central. Towards the end of Ubikashta Misham, recently translated into English, we're now on page 8, this is an earlier translation, tells the story that when he was a little boy, he was very lonely, didn't have any friends. He was about 7 or 6 years old when he's describing what happens here in this story. He's sitting in a room in Pruszyn in Poland. It's a very modest house, very modest little area where they lived. His parents and he and his father had Talmidim, a few Talmidim sitting around a rickety table and a few chairs in the room where his bed was in the corner. So he couldn't go to sleep because they were learning in the room and he would hear a discussion. And right next to him, the only friend that he ever had in the world was the Rambam, whose name was Moshe, like his father's name was Moshe. And the Rambam was sitting next to him on the bed, keeping him company. And they would begin a conversation. And Rav Moshe, the father, saying a shir to the few bachrim gathered around him, and they come to a shver Rambam, and everybody's beating up on the Rambam. The Ravid is beating up on the Rambam. Other Rishonim are beating up on the Rambam. Everybody's giving the Rambam a hard time. Rav Moshe puts his hand down, figures it out, saves the Rambam. For him, for the Rambam, everything is good. Shalom al Yisrael. Oh, what a bracha. Little Beryl, he was known, his name was Yosef, though, if he's happy. The Rambam sitting next to him is beaming. They saved me. He's happy, it's great. But then there were times, he says, when his father couldn't save the Rambam. When the questions on the Rambam were so strong that Rav Moshe put his hand down and he said, I give up, I can't save the Rambam. What follows, I want to read to you, because for me, this, and I know less than nothing, but for me, this is, it's got to be central in the shaping of Rabbi Soloveitchik's life. With a broken heart, right-hand side, in the middle. A sense of despair descends. Nebuch the Rambam is bested. And Nebuch the Rambam sitting next to him, he's starting to cry. That's it, ich bin a gehargete. With a broken heart, I would walk slowly to my mother. And I would say to my mother, Mother, Father cannot answer the Rambam. What are we going to do? Nebuch, Father didn't answer the Rambam, he's 6 years old. And what follows to me, and I know nothing, has to be a key to try to help understand the early and ongoing godless of Rabbi Soloveitchik. And my mother would tell me, don't worry. Father will find an answer to the Rambam. And if he does not succeed, then when you grow up, perhaps you will find an answer to the Rambam. Always remember, my son, the important thing about Torah is to study it in happiness and enthusiasm. Little Beryl worshipped his father. His father was the greatest thing to him. And his mother tells him, Pitzel, 6 years old, you know what? Don't worry about it. Your father will take care of the Rambam. But if he doesn't take care of the Rambam, I, your mother, am telling you that you're going to do what your father was not able to do. You're going to be greater than your father. I have confidence in you that you're going to firm for the Rambam. I can only imagine, and again, I don't know anything, what it means for a child to have a mother tell that child, I know that I have confidence in you. That's so powerful. And it all revolves around the Rambam. But the Rambam wasn't the only important figure in the Rav's life. And this brings me to fate and destiny and kol dodi dofek. Rav Soloveitchik wrote, first delivered in 1956 in the Nathan Lamp Auditorium of Yeshiva University. He delivered a talk, a manifesto on religious Zionism. If you go back historically to Yom HaTzmaut, May of 1956, just to frame it for a moment. So it was bitter vigal Nebuch for the state of Israel and for Jews worldwide. There was a tremendous amount of saber rattling on the part of Nasser and the Egyptian army. They were threatening to attack. The state of Israel is 8 years old, 1948, we're now in 1956. And in fact, just a few months later in October, the Suez War, the war of 1956, this is a few months before. State of Israel is panic-stricken, reaches out to the State Department of the United States for support. The State Department is not prepared to support Israel in May of 1956. They're not ready yet to reject Nasser. And it was a tremendously tense time. Up stands Rabbi Soloveitchik and delivers a massive address, 1960, published in Hebrew for the first time, Kol Dodi Dofek, translated now twice into English. And he uses the beginning of the fifth perek in Shir HaShirim. Ani Yishena V'Libi Er. I'm going to read it to you. Ani yishena v'libi er kol dodi dofek. There's a story here about a woman, a Shulamite maiden. So she's in love with a guy, and the guy's in love with her, and he's looking for her, and she goes home, and she gets undressed, she puts on her pajamas, and she takes off her shoes, and she puts on her nightgown, and she goes into bed. And then he comes to the house, and he's knocking on the door. And she's tired. It's been a long day. She's tired, and he's knocking, and she's tired, and she's not getting up, and he's knocking. And cold, do di do fake. There are two ways how to translate this. Either cold, do di do fake, a voice of my beloved is knocking, or probably more precisely, cold, exclamation point. A voice, a sound, do di do fake. But she's already tired. The psukim continue. I already took off my clothes. I'm already in bed. I'm not going to get my feet dirty. So she tarries. And by the time she gets up and goes to the door, the young man is gone. Let's read a little bit from the Nusach, the Lashon of Rabbi Soloveitchik. On page 9, at the bottom on the left side. What is the gist of the Song of Songs, if not the description of the tragic and paradoxical delay of the Shulamite maiden? Drunk with love and overwhelmed with yearning, when a favorable moment replete with awe and majesty beckoned to her, if not her missing that great, exalted, and momentous opportunity that she had dreamed about, fought for, and sought so passionately. The tender and delicate Shulamite maiden, impelled by longing for her bright-eyed beloved, roamed during sun-drenched days through the bypaths of vineyards and over the crests of mountains, through fields and gardens and during pale, magical moonlit nights, during pitch-black nights between the walls, searching for her beloved. One cold and rainy night, she returned to her tent, tired and worn out, and she fell fast asleep. The sound of quick and light footsteps could be heard in the silence of the tent on that strange and mysterious night. Suddenly the beloved emerged out of the dark and knocked on the door of his darling, who had intensely yearned for and awaited him. He knocked and he pleaded with her to open the door of the tent. Kol dodi dofek pischili rayasi, open the door, please, I beg you. The great moment that she had looked forward to with such impatience and longing materialized unexpectedly. Her elusive, self-concealing beloved, tired of wandering and hardships, appeared with his curly hair and his black eyes and powerful build and radiant countenance. He stood by her door, stretched his hand in through the hole in the latch, sought refuge from the damp of night, and wished to tell her about his powerful love, about his desires and yearnings, about a life of companionship filled with delight and joy, about the realization and attainment of their aspirations and hopes. Only the slight movement of stretching out her hand and turning the latch intervened between her and her beloved, between the great dream and its complete fulfillment. With a single leap, the Shulamite maiden could have obtained her heart's longing, but the heart is deceitful, and who can discern it? Precisely on that very night, a strange, stubborn indolence overcame her. For a brief moment, the fire of longing that had burned so brightly was dimmed. The fierce passion ebbed, her emotions were stilled, her dreams extinguished. The maiden refused to descend from the bed. She did not open the door of the tent to her handsome beloved. A cruel madness swept her into an abyss of oblivion and indifference. The maiden proved stubborn, lazy, and rained down a multitude of excuses and rationalizations to account for her peculiar behavior. I took off my coat already, I'm going to put it back on. I took off my shoes already, I'm going to put them back on. The beloved knocked again and again. And the more insistent his knocks, the louder they grew, the more icy, defiling madness increased in intensity. As the whispered entreaties of the beloved pierced the silence of the night, the heart of his darling became harder and harder like stone. The beloved continued to knock, pleading patiently. The maiden paid no heed to the voice of her beloved. The door to her tent remained shut up tight. The moment was lost, and the vision of an exalted light faded away. It's true that after a brief delay, the maiden awoke from her slumber, confused, startled, ran to open the door, but she arose too late. Her beloved had stopped knocking and vanished into the darkness of the night. Rabbi Soloveitchik develops from this incredibly poetic and powerful and passionate description of these three or four psukim in Shir HaShirim, beginning of Perek Hay, develops a whole manifesto of religious Zionism. And he continues to say, how 8 years ago in 1948, shortly after the Shoah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu came knocking at the door of the Jewish people. And he considers the founding of the State of Israel as a divine act, as an expression of God's desire to bring this state into existence. It's not just a state like any other state. It's not just a country like any other country. It's not like a flag like every other flag. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'chvaydeyu v'atzmai came knocking at the door of the Jewish people. And in 1956, he's telling his audience, don't do what you did not that long ago. During the time of the Shoah, you didn't do anything. Damning indictment of American Jewry for their passivity during the Shoah. And he blamed himself. He was living here then. We dare not let that happen again. And when HaKadosh Baruch Hu is knocking, in an ace tzara like the times in which we find ourselves, we have to open up the door and we have to respond and we have to be as supportive as possible. And he goes on and on and on. It's really an incredible book. For many years I thought, I asked myself, Vos epes Shir HaShirim? Why did the Rav go to Shir HaShirim to develop the importance of Eretz Yisrael, of Medinat Yisrael? I rang it krochum with the shulamis, with the knocking and the door. There's so many other sources that are available to us, even in Sefer Bereishis. So many places you could go. And I thought for a long time. And this, I didn't have an opportunity to ask him. I never checked it. I had this daydream that maybe what is going on here is a subtle anti-Satmar polemic. Because the Satmar Rebbe formulated his anti-Zionism around Psukim and Shir HaShirim. The famous Shalosh Shavuos, the three oaths, Yishpati Eschem Benos Yerushalayim, the Gemara all the way at the end of Maseches Ksubos, Shlo Yalu Yisrael Lachoma. For the Satmar Rebbe, Shir HaShirim is the source of anti-Zionism. So I thought, as I'm a Shagas I had, that maybe it's subtly, the Rav wanted a Dafka go to Shir HaShirim to show Adarab. But then, I think I discovered what is a much more plausible explanation. And that's at the top of page 11, because the source for this is a passage in the Kuzari of Yehuda Alevi. Yehuda Alevi in the Kuzari, in part 2, passage 24, is very upset about Bnei Yisrael, who after the Binyan Bayis Sheni, and after the opportunity, after Churban Bayis Rishon and after Golus Bavel, had the opportunity to go back to Israel and did not. And Ezra is knocking. And they're saying, come back, we have a Beis HaMikdash now. And Segevar Bazei Azoi Gutin Golus, they didn't go. And Yehuda Levi at the top of page 11 uses these psukim. Kol Dodi Dofei Pischi Lirai Yossi, as having been recited by the Nevi'im who wanted, and the leaders who wanted the Jews to come back, and the Jews didn't go back. And they suffered because they didn't go back. And all of Jewish destiny, says Yehuda Levi, is different because they didn't go back. And again, I don't know anything, but it's quite clear to me that what is looming large in Rabbi Soloveitchik's consciousness by using this particular passage in the context of the returning of Jews to Israel is absolutely rooted in this passage in the Kuzari. I want to give just one more theme and then I want to conclude. I mentioned earlier, so we have so far the centrality of Torah and Halacha, and I try to illustrate that to you via Nachem, via that the reality is determined by halachic categories, not by what you see. The combination of the act and the intellect, the mother and the emotions, the frailty of majesty, the majesty of frailty, the multiplicity of sources. And now my last one. As I get older, I find myself more and more coming back to one other passage in the writings of the Rav. I mentioned earlier my all-time high go-to passage is the Hesped for the Mechatenista. This is the second all-time high passage. And I found myself as a pulpit rabbi for many years, going back to this and now to try to help Chaverim and Talmidim. That is the issue of sadness and evil and suffering. One of the most intractable realities that we have to deal with as human beings is that Nebuch, there are things that go on in this world that we do not understand and that bring us an incredible amount of pain and sadness. And the question we ask ourselves and we try to ask others to try to help us is, how do you crawl out from under this? How do you put one foot in front of another foot after having experienced really deep sadness? How do you go on? How do you live a life after this? And the Rav here at the bottom of page 11, at the beginning of Fate and Destiny, gave us one yesod that is so exquisite in its simplicity. But I, again, this whole thing is about, this presentation is about my own inner feelings, is to me really very deeply profound. And that is, the Rav said, and you'll read it at the bottom of page 11, the question is not why. The why question is the wrong question. Judaism understood that evil cannot be blurred or camouflaged. It is impossible, towards the bottom left of page 11, to overcome the hideousness of evil through philosophical-speculative thought. You try to figure it out philosophically, it's a bracha levatala, it's a fangzach nishtun, you'll never get anywhere, you just beat up on yourself, you get frustrated, and you will be no way better off whatsoever. It is absolutely not helpful to you. The question is not why, but the question is what. On the right hand side, when the man of destiny suffers, he says to himself, evil exists and I will neither deny it nor camouflage it with vain intellectual gymnastics. I ask one simple question. What must the sufferer do so that he may live through his suffering? You'll never get an answer to the why question. Don't even ask. You're wasting your time. The real question is, so what do I have to do? What do I need to do to be able to wake up tomorrow morning and to live a quasi-relatively meaningful life? And that's where the Avodah is. That's the direction of trying to think rather than think and waste your time with the why. So there are a lot of things that the Rav taught us. And as I said, this is like an embarrassment to try to summarize a towering, a powerful intellect and personality. You know, like which shtickle Torah of the Rav's am I going to share with you that will show you the dazzling pyrotechnics of his genius? And there were so many of them. But these are the thoughts that I want to leave with you in memory of Rabbi Soloveitchik. And so, as we pass his 20th Yahrzeit, and as tonight Rabbi Silber inaugurates a lecture series on the Rav in commemoration of the 20th Yahrzeit, so we want to remember him as best as we can. His original mind and his charismatic personality, his intimate knowledge of and his incredible appreciation for the totality of Jewish tradition, while at the same time enjoying mastery over the philosophical contributions of Western culture, his intense fealty to the Mesorah, intense fealty to the Mesorah, combined with a real openness to the best in the world around him, his spellbinding oratorical skills and his charming sense of humor, his radical intellectual honesty and demanding search for truth, his dazzling intellect and total lack of pretense, his extraordinary power of self-revelation and his deep-seated sense of privacy, the courage of his convictions to blaze his own trail and to do what he thought was right even when it wasn't easy, and his amazing ability, and chaval al da'avdin, his amazing ability to present our tradition unadulterated and uncompromised in a way that profoundly resonated with the modern American mind. He was an extraordinary teacher. He was a master pedagogue who challenged, inspired, and excited young and old alike. Moreinu v'Rabbeinu Harav Yosef Dov ben Harav Moshe Halevi Tehei Nishmaso Tzurura B'Tzurur HaChayim. Thank you.
You took away my whole lecture, so it's about
Did you daven Ma'ariv yet?
No. So just a reminder, there'll be Ma'ariv in the base Medrash.
What time is coming?
In just a few moments.
She's coming in when? 10:14. Okay, so we can do it.
This is my brother, Ellie. No, he lives in Baltimore.
How are you?